everyone. Welcome to the third episode of HDSA's podcast. I'm Louise Vetter. I'm the president and CEO of the Huntington's Disease Society of America, better known as HDSA. And in this month's episode, I am joined by some amazing people. First, I'm going to be talking with Marianne Emmerich, who's part of the HDSA staff team supporting our youth programming, our advocacy, and so many of the community services that we bring for HD families. And then later on in the conversation, I'm talking with Drs. Jim Gasella and Marcy McDonald out of Boston, who were pivotal in the discovery of the Huntington gene 30 years ago. So it's a really important anniversary scientifically that both Jim and Marcy are going to talk about with us today. But without further ado, I want to welcome guest number one, Marianne. Marianne, are you nervous talking with me today?
Always, Louise. I'm always nervous talking to you.
It's such a everybody. It's such a ridiculous thing. Marianne and I have this like joke, but I'm excited about this conversation because there's so much going on in terms of youth programming, and the big Congress was just held in Scotland with HDEO. I know you came back all fired up about that. So I'm hoping we can get into some of that a little bit in our conversation as well. But maybe for folks who don't know you, Marianne, can you share a little bit about what you do at HDSA and maybe how you got involved in this work?
Absolutely. So my official title is Manager of Youth and Community Services here at HDSA. Been working for HDSA on the team, the mission team, for about almost 3 years now. I started getting involved about 12 years ago as a volunteer. I come from an HD family. My mom passed away 12 years ago from Huntington's disease, and I sort of jumped in head first and went to my first walk and was like, this is where I need to be, and found the NYA shortly after and sort of wanted to make that my mission of just making sure that other young people, other young adults just don't feel alone in their journey.
It's so interesting that, and we talk about this often, that you have the personal experience. You also have lots of layers of professional experience, being a volunteer leader through the NYA. I know you were actually sort of president or chair of the NYA. I never know what title we use. And then you've been involved at Terence Cardinal Cook, and now you're a social worker. If you think back 10, 12 years ago, did you know that this is where you were going to be in life?
So when I first started going to school after high school, when I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life, I wanted to find a cure for HD, right? But then I had to dissect a cat, and that was just not my thing. So then I was like, what else can I do? And the social worker that worked with my mom was really supportive in my life and my journey through that. And I was like, maybe I could do that. And so when I did go back to school, I went to school for social work. And then I started working at Terence Cardinal Cook as the program manager there. And I thought I was going to be there forever, honestly. I knew I wanted to do something in the HD community. I just didn't know exactly what.
And then we tapped you on the shoulder. And said,
yeah,
please.
And I was like, oh my goodness, I would do this for free, but now it could be, yeah. So I felt making that decision was probably one of the hardest decisions, leaving Terence Cardinal Cook. I still go all the time, but I definitely felt like I could make a greater impact on a more national level and helping young people not feel alone in this. And that was always my mission, because for me, I felt so alone growing up, even though, I knew about HD my entire life and my family was always very supportive. But it was always the elephant in the room, and we didn't necessarily feel so comfortable talking about it. And I didn't want that for other people.
When you were at Terence Cardinal Cook, I think it's obvious that you were working with the residents who were at, the the home, because that's how I see TCC as a home. But you also were working with families and really sort of their entire journey. Coming to HDSA, you're much more focused on that young adult and even younger, right? That youth journey. And how do you bring your experience to your work at HDSA?
Ooh, that's a good question. That was always initially really a challenging way, like trying to figure out when to put that hat on and when it would be beneficial and helpful for a family or for a young person to know that. And I've learned in different ways how to bring it in and share my experience when I think it will be beneficial. It is challenging still, but I do feel like I understand what they have gone through or what they are going through. And being able to just share a piece of what I had gone through in order to help them feel more comfortable in sharing really benefits the relationship and the support that I could provide.
So often I talk about a critical part of our mission being to break down the isolation that often families affected by HD feel. And so being able to have that conversation, right, and create that relationship and that sameness and that community is really at the heart of what the National Youth Alliance, the NYA, is, right? I know that the word Ohana, right, you know, that sort of big concept of family united by a journey is really critical to the NYA. And it's why we think about the National Youth Alliance as a mission service, not a volunteer network, right? Like not a recruitment tool or an event, right? It's very much, it's a mission. For folks who may not know the NYA, what would you want them to know about it?
I would say the most important thing about the NYA is that Ohana piece, is that connecting young people and youth that are impacted by HD in whatever that means. That could be friends, that could be people, you know, that have gone through the testing process, that have a sibling or a parent that have Huntington's disease or juvenile onset Huntington's disease, anybody that is impacted or has a loved one, is making those connections in the community and being able to identify like other support outside of their family network, because our family doesn't necessarily have to be our blood relatives, right? We can find support from different ways and different places and different people around the country that just get it. And I feel like the NYA is that community for young people and peers, that support.
But it's not just the community, right? Because you mentioned the services and the support. Mm-hmm. So we have youth social workers that are very focused on being available to the NYA and not just folks who are officially connected with the National Youth Alliance, but anyone who's young and needs more support.
We also help just as a little youth social workers. They obviously have that specific youth, young adult training behind it and just can identify with specific support for young people, but also they're able to help providers understand what young people might be going through. So even we have, you know, myself included, have talked to different, you know, counselors or therapists or school providers that just don't understand what a young person might be going through in their at-home life.
That's really important. What other programs does the NYA do?
So we also have NYA retreats. So this year we have 4 retreats. And so anybody that's ever been to the HDSA convention has seen the NYA talent show or NYA day or knows about it. It's the day before convention actually officially starts. And so these retreats are sort of smaller versions of NYA days, and they're weekend long. They're full of support, education, and lots of fun. But again, like I think is the most important out of all of these events is that connecting young people with others that just understand and get it. And so we have 4 of them in different regions of the U.S. We also have a youth mentorship program that we've collaborated with HDO, and it's sort of like a peer-to-peer support, but they get a little bit extra support from myself and the youth social workers, right? And so we have mentors and mentees, and the mentors go through a training process with myself and HDO team, and they get that extra support from us and the youth social workers. And we sort of play matchmaker and pair them up with somebody that might be going through something that they've already been through or are going through as well.
Which is really important. And I love that the mentor program, which we actually launched sort of in the middle of COVID, right? You know, and we were able to do it in partnership with HDO and the Huntington Society of Canada, is able to take the support and sort of, you know, add that extra layer, which I think is so meaningful. Speaking of HDO, you just came back from Scotland. And for folks who may not be familiar with the Huntington's disease, if I'm going to say the full words, right? Huntington's disease youth organization, which in many ways was founded after the National Youth Alliance to be able to model that type of youth support on a global scale, recognizing that the NYA is, you know, an HDSA program very focused on families across the United States. The HDO is a really important global partner to be able to make sure that the international HD family has support for the youngest members. But this was the first full like international meeting of HDO, right?
Yeah. So initially it was the first one was supposed to be in 2020, but unfortunately had to get canceled. But so yeah, so this was the first one in person in Scotland and it was unbelievable.
How many families? I mean, not how many families, I'm sorry. How many countries were there? That's what I meant to ask.
Okay. I had a feeling you were going to ask that question and I was like, I should look this up. And I didn't. So I'm not sure, but I believe there was over 20 countries that were there. I remember it being a lot of, you know, even just one person coming from different countries. And then all of a sudden there was a surprising like 40 people from Belgium, right? And just people that didn't know each other, people in the US that didn't know each other that came over. It was amazing to see how many different countries were represented.
That's awesome. And I didn't mean to pop quiz you. I know that for events like this, especially international groups, like they often talk about that reach. And HDO has done so many sort of country specific outings over the years. I know they were in Australia for a few weeks. I know they've gone down to South America specifically to engage youth in countries where there aren't, you know, sort of that network of youth community and support. So I figured it was a fantastic number. And knowing that being in Scotland, it was definitely going to attract European participation. Belgium is not a very big country. So
I know.
People is amazing.
And so. I have family in Belgium. So I'm like, wait a second. that was one that I was very surprised about. But there was people from all over the world and people that don't not even necessarily have like youth or young adult specific resources, but don't even have like a national organization like HDSA or other advocacy organizations around the world. So it was really humbling to and just sort of upsetting as well, but because there isn't more support for a lot of different places.
So when you go to events like this, right? And we're all traveling, right? Everyone on the HDSA staff team goes to different events, whether it's convention or local special events or events that other HD organizations like Help for HD and HD Reach put on. We all work really collaboratively on the mission side of things, right? And being able to fight Huntington's disease, you know, first and foremost. So when you go to these types of events, you're going to provide services and be an ambassador, but you also go to learn, right? And that's it makes us all stronger when we learn from what others are doing. So what did you take back from or bring back from going to this huge event?
So much, honestly. It wasn't anything specific like that I learned something new, right? And I always learn so many different things at these educational events, but it was more so how many countries, how many individual human beings are doing so much work to, you know, for their family, for their communities, and that they're doing it alone. And it made me feel like, you know, and you could just see the collaboration with everyone and how much stronger we all are together. And it gave us that platform to, you know, share our experiences, share what we're doing in our own spaces, in our own communities more locally, and try to figure out how we could better ourselves, right? I left, so I did a few sessions there and presented with other people from other countries. And I was like, I'm doing nothing. I can't wait to get back. And it really was inspiring to see like the potential that, you know, HDSA's NYA youth programs could potentially be one day. You know, for other these smaller countries that are a lot easier maybe to get to people, but it was really inspiring to see even just on an individual level what people are doing and trying to do to better the community.
Well, I'm so glad you went. You bring inspiration to the halls of HDSA, our tiny halls in our tiny little office. But
are you saying because I'm always really loud? Is that
why? No. It's because you're always sitting on the floor stopping traffic. No. If you know Marianne, she's not a fan of chairs. I'm just putting that out there. But honestly, it's such a pleasure and such a joy to have you on the team. We are all stronger when we work together, and certainly your experiences and your just persistent focus on how we help one another is at the heart of who we are. So one of the downsides of a podcast is that folks can't see your smiling face and they can't see the sign that's behind you, which says, "You make my heart smile." So Marianne, thank you for all you do. You make my heart smile.
Thank you, Louise. You make my heart smile too.
Aw, through the screen. There's so much going on. Just picking up on that theme of when we fight Huntington's disease, it takes all of us working together. Our next guests today are talking about the role of families in the discovery of the Huntington gene and how it took all of us as a global community working together to make that happen, and how continuing that togetherness is what gives Jim and Marcy hope for the future. So I look forward to continuing that conversation with them. And Marianne, thanks so much for all you do and for joining me on this podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel really special.
Talk to you soon. Our next guests for this episode of the podcast are Drs. Jim Gazella and Marcy McDonald, longtime friends of HDSA, who I'm thrilled to have with us to talk about some major milestones in HD research. Jim Gazella is a professor of neurogenetics at the Department of Genetics at Harvard Medical School, and Dr. Marcy McDonald is professor of neurology at Mass General Hospital. Marcy and Jim, thank you so much for taking time to be a part of this conversation.
Pleasure to be here.
It is.
So 2023 is a big year. It marks 40 years since Huntington was first molecularly mapped on the human chromosome and 30 years since the sequence was, you know, specifically identified to identify HD on the Huntington gene. That feels like a long time and a blink of the eye at the sort of the same, at the same time. Jim and Marcy, can like 40 and 30 years. How does that feel to you guys?
It makes me feel old. I agree with you, Louise. It's been long in a blink. Unbelievable. And if I look back on it now, all these years, since you're asking us these questions, it's really fun to think about the fact that 30 years ago, when we first saw what the mutation was, this expanded CAG repeat at this gene that was then called HD, but is now called HTT, We didn't know anything. I mean, nothing. And 30 years later, some people might argue, we know too much, so we don't know what's important. But that's why Jim and I continue to do genetics, because the same genetic approaches, or rather the general genetic approach with better ways of doing it now than then, can tell us what's important. And that still excites me. And it keeps our genetic work going, because now we're in a position to look for genetic DNA variants that are, you know, carried in families, inherited in families, that are modifying the onset and other features of Huntington's disease. And, you know, we don't know enough about those yet. So we know a lot about other stuff, but we don't know enough about those yet. So that's what excites me. So that's the blink in the eye, or the blink of an eye part of it. I want to know more now.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, when we first found the marker back in 83, the technologies just weren't there to do much more, and they had to all be developed. So the whole field of Huntington's disease research really grew with, in parallel with, and helping the development of technologies for the Human Genome Project. So now the tools that we can apply today are just so much more advanced than what existed then. It's amazing. But on the other hand, the questions are that much harder, because you've got to go deeper and deeper and deeper to get to the things that are impacting. We've known, as you said, for 30 years what the sequence is that triggers the disease, but to figure out exactly how it works and how to influence it so that we can modify it requires a much, much deeper look. Now, fortunately, the techniques are there, and the number of people working in Huntington's disease has increased dramatically. So there's a lot more going on, but the questions are hard. And we're, you know, the long part of it is wishing we had come to a treatment before this by getting a little bit luckier. I think we were a little bit lucky in getting the marker so early, given the technology as it existed. I think we paid for that in the 10 years that it took to get the gene, because we had to make up for those technologies. But since then, we're on the track of trying to understand enough to develop a treatment. And that's just a really much harder problem. But I do think the technologies are there to do it. I hope it comes soon.
It's interesting. I was going to use the word lucky in a follow-up question, because I have heard it described that finding the marker was remarkably easy, Jim. Right. You know, and which, not being a scientist, sounds, you know, sort of ridiculous to me. Right. But like something like the 12th try and you had it sort of figured out. And then those next 10 years were sort of a slog. Right. Like a lot of people, you know, doing a lot of research. And that's even reflected in the 1993 paper not being authored by just a few people, but by an entire group. Marcy, do you want to talk a little bit about that collaborative and sort of the collaborative nature of HD science? Because I know over the years, you and I have talked about how that's really unique in the HD field.
Oh, I'm so happy that you ask about that. It really is a family disorder, not just that it's inherited within families, but the cloning of the gene. Before the cloning of the gene, the mission, if you to call it a mission, to find the genetic mutation, people worked collaboratively as part of the Huntington's Disease Research Collaborative Group. And it really was, in many ways, a binding together of different people in different laboratories, who each brought to the table a different set of skills, but with an understanding of the skills of the others and how to use them in an integrated way. I want to give Jim a lot of credit for making this work, in essence, because one of the important things is, especially when a lot of young scientists are involved and trainees, is everybody has to be able to further their academic progression. And one of the most important things is to be able to show that you've contributed along the way in a paper or a manuscript, giving talks, presenting what you're doing. And Jim has this absolutely uncanny ability, in my mind, to see the opportunities where everybody can get something. And along the way, I think that was really critical in allowing the collaboration to grow organically for people who work together in a really integrated fashion. And it was just so great that people were competitive, I would say, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Really, anything you've ever heard about no egos, that's not true. But it was a feeling that everybody could get something that they needed for their careers and for their interests along the way for this mission. And so it was highly competitive, which was a really good thing, but in a way where everybody knew they were going to be able to get something, which is allows people to share. And if you have something to share with somebody else and you share it, and there's a reason to do so because it's going to help you, that's great. And so I credit Jim for that. Largely.
Well,
largely.
It was partly the, there were two aspects. One is, of course, everybody had a common goal, and everybody learned very early on by connection with the HD community, the patient community, how worthy that goal was and how it really should be a single-minded goal. So what happened was the teams that came into the collaboration came because they had a particular expertise, and they got so committed to the goal that they didn't limit themselves to that expertise. They applied it, but they also did other things that overlapped with each of the other teams. So everybody was doing stuff that overlapped with each of the others. And, you know, that can prove difficult. But the thing is, it was taking a long time because, as I said, the technologies had to really be developed and perfected for them to work in HD. And HD set the example for many of them that then the technologies were used in other fields, other diseases. But because it was taking time, there sort of was a recognition that you can't just wait until the end to publish. You got to present the steps along the way, both for people's academic progression, but also so the field knows what's going on and that what you're doing can be used in these other diseases. So in seeing what the steps were along the way, it became obvious who could get credit for particular steps because they were the major contributors to them. It was just a matter of getting people to recognize that these could be published papers along the way that demonstrated those steps. And so everybody got their credit. And so for me, it was fairly obvious that we should do that.
I think the other, listening to Jim, I think the other aspect of this, it's sort of self-selecting because it's the time factor. For people in the labs actually doing a lot of this work, all of the work, people who wanted to contribute and weren't necessarily out for a quick paper or, you know, a sort of maybe at that time anyway, more typical mindset. So the students and the postdocs had a time limit simply because of academic progression, but the some postdocs, some students stayed with it because they were really interested in pushing it along. And they stayed with it maybe longer than some of their other mentors were telling them they should stay with it.
And that's why you see so many of them still working on HD today.
Right?
That's right. They're leaders in the field.
Yeah, it's really interesting when I look at the authors, right? The co-authors on that collaborative. And it's Nancy Wexler, of course. It's Frances Collins from the NIH. Leslie Thompson, of course. You know, really, really well-known leaders in the field of science. And, I'm struck by that dynamic of collaboration and competition. Do you think that driving force is still present in HD science today?
I think it is. I think that the common goal now is treatment, right? And treatment requires very different expertises across the field. The sort of knowledge of how to run a clinical trial and do a clinical trial has always been there, but the kinds of treatments that are being suggested are new, and they have to be merged with that. And the kinds of treatments that are being suggested are based on mechanisms that are being investigated at the basic science lab bench level. So that's another integration. So what you end up with is, I don't think it's the same as the goal of cloning the gene, where there was one gene and somebody would get there first. I think there's a possibility of multiple different approaches to treatment. And I think within each of those approaches, teams form that are collaborative, competitive, because everybody wants to push it forward as fast as they can. But there are also, there are rules for how fast you can push things when it gets to actually doing clinical trials, et cetera. So I think there are still teams. I think the teams are competitive. I think it's actually one of the cases where I see, even in industry, where there are people working to develop treatments for Huntington's disease, that I would guarantee you that if somebody's successful, their competitors aren't going to be unhappy. They're going to be very happy that somebody was successful.
I agree because
the disease, you really become committed to this disease.
That's the family aspect, Louise. It even reaches into industry. As much as that sounds a little odd, I think, because biotech and industry is, to a certain extent, has within it people who came up from this era of figuring out what the gene was, and their trainees, clinical or basic research, who have gone on to become a part of this end of biomedicine. And that speaks to the bigger, broader family of HD.
Absolutely. And that is something that at HDSA we are constantly looking to showcase, right, is that not only is this a family disease, but that, we are building that broader global family of scientists and clinicians and people with HD and all of their friends and loved ones who care to create change. Finding the gene was maybe easy, right? Maybe. But treating the disease is proving to be infinitely more challenging.
But I would say, Louise, that the time from finding the gene to having potential, I'll call them gene-based clinical candidates go in to clinical trials is relatively short.
Doesn't feel that way, Marcy.
I know, but I think it's more of a everybody wants this now feeling of it's not ever fast enough. But if you look at it, the progress that has been made, I would argue, even candidates in trials has been amazing, absolutely amazing.
Yeah, there is a, you know, there is a certain parallel in essence. When we got the marker, the technologies weren't there to get the gene. They had to be developed, and we had to apply them over a number of years, and we got to the gene. When we cloned that gene, the technologies were not there to do anything with nucleic acid-based treatments. They just didn't exist. And so that all developed subsequently, and it happens that Huntington's disease looked like a really good target for applying those technologies. And so that's why things, in fact, drove forward faster with Huntington's disease than with many other diseases. But it does take time. Now, unfortunately, those initial attempts didn't come through. But they built a base both of information and a base of people interested in getting to the end that it's, I think, is allowing them to be applied more broadly in parallel rather than waiting for the next sort of sequential step in the process. And that's where we differ from the cloning of the gene. The cloning of the gene, there was only one. The treatment, there could ultimately be more than one. Hopefully, you know, they're successful in parallel and get it done soon. But there are multiple different approaches that are now being tried, virtually all of which, those kinds of approaches didn't exist 30 years ago.
It is uniquely a very loud day in New York City, so I keep having to put my microphone on mute. Sorry, guys. But absolutely, finding the gene was one thing, right? And now there are so many different teams working in parallel to develop disease-modifying therapies with that genetic base. And so it's, you know, for a long time, there has been a tremendous effort to find different ways to symptomatically treat the disease and help ease the burden of illness on our community. But we are at, you know, a really exciting pivot point in clinical science where we're able to dream and see things being tested that could potentially get to that genetic root. Imagine 10 years from now, where are we going to be?
Jimmy's looking at me, and I'm looking at.
I'm not great with predictions. I know that when the gene was cloned, there were some people who said, "Oh, in 5 years we'll have a treatment," and I wasn't one of those people. But you don't want to disagree with those people because, you know, they were given enthusiasm to everything. So where will we be in, you know, 10 years? I think that we know enough from human genetics that the disease can be influenced because it's influenced by genetic variation from inhuman patients themselves. Human individuals carrying that gene show differences in the onset timing and the rate of progression, and it is because, in part, of their other genetic complement, other genes. And because we know that the proof of principle is therefore established, the difficulty becomes one of engineering the same kind of modification in a clinical trial that occurs naturally in people's DNA and making it stronger so that the effects that we see in the population based on the genes that people have of a little bit of delay in onset or a little bit of delay in progression get turned into a larger delay in onset and a larger delay in progression. I think that, again, we don't know exactly what the best route is to do that. We know that there are genes that if you inactivate them are going to delay the onset of the disease. But do you inactivate them by finding a small molecule drug that inhibits them? Or do you inactivate them by using the same kind of approach that was attempted to inactivate the Huntington in the big Roche trial? Or do you inactivate them by using more modern CRISPR techniques to actually go in and manipulate the DNA? All of these things are being tried. Whether one of them will have been successful in that period of time, I don't know, but I think there's a really good shot because it's a combination of attempts that are sort of frontier type attempts, all the way back to things that are really well established in the pharma industry of knowing how to do things. You know, small molecules, they understand very well. CRISPR, it's, you know, like Star Wars kind of ideas. But on the other hand, there's lots of people using it now for lots of things. So you've got a range of possibilities for what might work. I think one of those is likely to have worked. And so I think where we'll probably be now that I've gotten at a long rambling answer is I think we'll probably be at a point of having at least a delaying treatment for onset or progression of the disease. I think one of the biggest critical parameters in the success is how early one can do the clinical trial. The earlier we can do a clinical trial for any of these kinds of treatments, the better the success is going to be when it works.
I completely agree with Jim, and I would add that I was floored at a meeting just a couple of days ago to hear that there are over 50 biotech and pharma entities working on these exact things. So that gives me a lot of hope, because those aren't the kinds of things we do in the laboratory.
No.
All we can do is to point out what genetic variants might be important for people to consider when they're looking for delaying treatments. And that's our job. At least that's my job. You may have more than one job.
Yeah, no, I think identifying the genetic variations that do influence the disease is something we do. And I think that also putting a little more meat on the bone there of trying to get people to understand how they do it. We do have a pretty good idea for those that are involved in the DNA expansion itself, the CAG repeat. I think we don't have as much for the things that influence the consequences of that directly. And I think, but we do have some clues. So I think that's where our next sort of contribution is going to be, is is extending the number of things that those 50 biotech companies can aim at to try to alter the disease.
Yes, that's right. And I think the genetics has put a real focus on steps like the continued expansion of that long CAG repeat in the cells of the brain. As time goes on, that repeat gets longer and longer and longer and longer. And so some of these companies are working on some of the enzymes that are involved in that getting longer and longer and longer over time, some of the proteins that are involved in that process. Even though we don't know exactly what that process is, some of the players are known from the genetics.
Yeah.
And so I think even without all the complicated biology of all the things that are happening in the brain cells, just being able to focus on some of these particular entities from the genetics has been really gratifying to see how this is being picked up by these entities that know how to find drugs, know how to do some of these clinically relevant things needed to get us to the next step. 10 years, I could see there being huge advances.
And I do want to point out that, you know, in that same theme of it took technologies from 83 to 93 to get the gene, and new technologies are now being applied to try to develop treatments now that we have the gene. We have the gene. We also have modifiers of that are genes, et cetera. All of those, the only reason we have them is because HD individuals participated in research.
That's right.
You know, when we talk about doing Huntington's disease genetics, we're talking about analyzing the DNA of 20,000 individuals with Huntington's disease. If we didn't have those 20,000 individuals participating in research, none of these things would have been done. We would still be at the level of saying the only target is the Huntington's gene itself. And then how do we make, you know, how do we target it? We wouldn't know. But with the fact that we can find genes that, that influence the disease, we provide a lot more targets, but we can only do that because we find them because HD individuals participated in research. So that was, that's in a sense a part of the timeline as well, is that it took time to, for that number of people to accumulate in the research studies.
That's really interesting because it took two families in before 83 with the linkage.
Yep.
Two families, big families, important families, an American family, a Venezuelan family. The cloning of the gene took about 100 families to find, using genetic and molecular techniques, 100 different unrelated families and people from those families who participated. And now, just as Jim just mentioned, it's 20,000 contributing to that next big step, which is how do you modify the effects of that expanding mutation? And the community has been incredible in participating in this. It's really a huge effort.
It is a huge effort, and it's the HD families, etc. It's also the clinical researchers who commit to doing it.
Absolutely.
And so it's really been back to that whole idea of a family. You know, it's one enormous family that's causing this to happen. We just happen to be the people that look at the DNA.
That's right.
Well, and that's an incredibly important part of the process, right? So I appreciate that. Thank you so much for being a part of those projects 40 and 30 years ago, and for all that you continue to do. I know that folks who listen to this podcast and who follow the field of HD science know your names as really drivers of genomic change and scientific understanding of Huntington's disease, but always with the families in mind. And I do think that's special in HD. And I know that the two of you really embody and are inspired by that dynamic. And so thank you so much again for all that you do. There are a lot of folks who are working to support science, not just what's coming out of your labs, but, you know, globally, and together it matters. And, you know, for our listeners, you heard it here first. There's a lot of hope from, you know, these scientists, and that's pretty amazing. So Jim and Marcy, thank you for everything and for being part of this ongoing effort. When I asked you where you'd be in 10 years or what you saw ahead, I half expected you to say that you'd have a margarita by your side on a sunny porch. But I know that you're both driven to see change for the better. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
All you right. are so welcome, Louise. This has been fun.
Wow. Yeah. For all of our listeners, stay tuned for our next episode. And thank you for listening to another episode of HDSA's podcast and another fantastic conversation, this time with Jim Gasella and Marcy McDonald. And at HDSA, family is everything. So we'll keep fighting this fight. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.